And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour Top 10 with Dean Haglund and Phil Lernis. Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Well, hello there, Dean Haglund. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Phil Lernis. How are you?
Are you getting excited about your trip over here to the States?
Oh my gosh, I got an art table full of art that needs to be completed before I can get on that plane. So I'm trying not to think of it. I'm just trying to focus on completing all these watercolors for a potential art show coming up.
Well, now that's the art show that will take place in Los Angeles, is it not?
Yes, that's the one.
And you would be delivering them on your way through town to head to Dallas for the convention where I'm meeting you and your fellow lone gunman?
That's correct, to the convention. Yes, I'll be dropping off the artworks and then the curator will be, when I come back through, I'll be framing them and mounting them, leaving them with the curator who will then hang the show, and then I show up for opening.
And when theoretically would that be? When are we looking at for the opening of that art show?
July 13th to coincide with the world famous art walk in downtown Los Angeles.
Wow. So that would be a lot of fun. Okay.
Wouldn't it?
We will keep everybody apprised of this. This would be, I mean, a live podcast, too, from that could be amazing. We might even have to stream that sucker like we did for the Mayan Podcastathon.
Oh, my gosh. As long as it doesn't go 28 hours, I'll be fine with it.
So that would be an exciting live event. And that, my friends, is the perfect segue into this, our first theme show. In episode 2 of year 11 of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, we've often celebrated the live events, but never before, I think, have we ever counted them down in an arbitrary assignment of numbers that we call our top 10 live events. These are, as we mentioned last week, these are plays. They might be musicals. They might be comedy shows. What they are not are musical concerts. No bands, no singers. Whitney Houston at the Greek Theater. No, it wasn't the Greek Theater. It was Shoreline Amphitheater. I already ruined it. Whitney Houston at the Shoreline Amphitheater back in 86. We'll have to wait. She will not
Red
be
Hot
on
Chili Peppers on the first tour. When their first guitar player was still alive.
I don't understand why you rejected my. I'm gonna keep this on the table, and we're gonna record this sometime. There's for those who don't know, there's been a meme going around on Facebook that is 10 concerts you've seen, and one of them is a lie. And I want us to count down our top 10 all-time favorite concerts and explain why there are our favorite concerts. And one of them will be completely a lie. It's a real band. Right. It's just we're lying that we were there. And and then the following week, you and I will have to guess which one was our lie. And our listeners are allowed to participate and guess. And maybe if they guess correctly, there will be a little gift for them.
See, now I here's the thing that I would think be wrong with that. And I can't believe we're talking our production thing on the air. But the one that is the lie will have the most inaccurate details because somebody who theoretically was there, I mean, I can't go say, oh, yeah, I saw Whitney Houston when she stubbed her toe. And they go, well, that never happened. And then that's obviously I'm caught up in the lie.
Well, then so the reason that you're trying to avoid it is because you know your lie is going to be exposed. I know mine will not be. So anyway, but you're right. We will, I'll just, in a moment of weakness when you're exhausted on some trip, I'll just force you into this one. And,
okay. and that'll be hilarious.
But okay, this week, live events, we love the live events. Do you have any honorable mentions that might explore or reveal what criteria you used in narrowing your list?
Well, see, here's the thing. So many of the live events that were memorable were ones that I was in. So I really tried to avoid shows that I participated were in. I have two or three here just because they're so extraordinary. But, you know, I sort of go for the live event that was much more amazing, historical, you know, the thing that you'll never see again. So, yeah, there's some honorable mentions.
Celebrating the ephemeral nature of these. Yes, I, it's not about necessarily the best, although, I mean, I guess one of these could even be the worst, but it's for me, because they are ephemeral, because they're things that we can't say, hey, you need to go check this out. It, therefore, right. for me, is about, hey, here's what I learned. Here was the takeaway. And here's how it really affected my development as a human being, as an artist.
Yeah.
And so that's how I approach this list. And I did eschew entirely any shows in which I played a part.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Okay, well, I got a couple.
Honorable
mentions.
Maybe
I should start with your honorable mentions.
Yes, okay.
So there was a time in Vancouver where an NBA franchise started up called the Vancouver Grizzlies. Now I think sold to Nashville, the Nashville Grizzlies,
no,
if I'm not
Memphis.
Mistaken.
Memphis Grizzlies.
Memphis, yes, because so many Grizzlies live in Memphis. And why not?
Don't get me started on this. That's like when the Salt Lakes, when the New Orleans Jazz moved to Salt Lake and they didn't think about changing their name. And I advocated all throughout the 80s that the Los Angeles Lakers, who had moved from Minneapolis, the land of many lakes.
10,000 lakes.
I advocated that the Los Angeles NBA franchise and the Utah franchise conduct a trade, and the trade be simply their nicknames, because there are no lakes in Los Angeles and there is no Jazz in Salt Lake. I mean, can you imagine how great it would have been? The Great Salt Lakers for the Utah team.
Yeah.
And the LA Jazz. Oh my God, that would have been outstanding. But anyway, the show that you were describing, Dee.
Oh, right. So in a desperate attempt to figure out what would make Vancouver's NBA shows unique, they were experimenting with halftime entertainment. And one of the things, in front of a crowd of 16,000 people, when the Grizzlies did play the LA Lakers, was I and another improviser improvised on the court for 16,000 people. It's one thing to do, sing the national anthem, you know the words, and there's a music behind you. It's another thing to go on to the court with no script and have two cameras, mobile cameras, running around filming you, putting you up on the Jumbotron over your head, and you have to do 10 minutes of comedy, improvising with, I think, Mia Peoples from MTV was doing my arms, and that anything you said got a roar of laughter from 16,000 people, and then afterwards you go backstage and there's Shaq staring down at you.
I don't like working blue. You know this, but I got to tell you, any experience where Nia Peoples touched me in any way would have been very near the top of my list.
Well, there you go. So
yeah,
that's
a serious crush for Phil Larness in his formative years. So I'm glad you brought that up.
She was delightful.
That puts the honorable into honorable mention, my friend.
right. And yes, absolutely. It's
can I share
mind-altering?
An honorable mention, since you're talking about the improv and the sketch comedy. One that I always regretted that you didn't get to see here in Los Angeles as part of SciFest. was Moby Alpha by the sketch group Charles.
Yes.
This was long form. It was 45 minutes, one act, and it was Moby Dick in outer space, but also a parody of every great space film ever made. And I always wish that you had had a chance to see this. What else is on honorable mention?
Well, I don't know. I have the rare honor of being one of, I think, only three or four admirals in a Star Trek charity known as Barfleet. Now, this is a Midwestern charitable organization that goes to sci-fi conventions and sets up a free bar, but then auctions off things and raises money for charity. So it's it allows these conventions to party crazy, as you can imagine. And they're very specific on people who volunteer, have to go through all the ranks of yeoman and first class and cadet and all that sort of thing. But if you are very keen on, you get to be made through a ceremony that you have to recite things and stuff like that, you get to be made an honorary admiral. So I am admiral of Barfleet, of all things. And that,
well,
that event,
that is quite an honor. That really, again, you are putting the honor into honorable mention.
Yes, exactly. So there you go. So those are some of the events that I participated in, that I was part of.
You know, apropos of our 10th anniversary show from a couple weeks back, where you complained about how, unlike me, you never get to drink for free. You're always the one paying for the drinks. One would think an admiral of Barfleet would drink for free, honestly.
Well, everybody, but this is the thing. Everybody drinks for free at Barfleet. That's the thing.
Oh.
They make their money from the auctions of stuff donated.
So you were
stuff donated.
Complaining unfairly, unduly in that episode. That was dishonorable. That almost qualified you for a dishonorable discharge from your honorable mention. All right.
Okay, wait a sec. No, no. Okay.
Any other,
we'll talk later.
Any other honorable mentions?
Well, of course, all the cons, the Fed, the Dragon Cons, the Comic Cons, all of those have been incredible live events, just for the sheer number and the enjoyment. And FedCon in Germany, all of those I sort of encapsulated into one sort of honorable mention of all the conventions I've ever been to and all the fans who've come and by and said hi. It's been quite memorable over the years and will continue to be in the future.
I have a few different categories of this. My honorable mention Broadway edition is A Behanding in Spokane from Martin McDonagh. You know, the cast, unbelievable. Christopher Walken, but especially Sam Rockwell. Anthony Mackie,
so good,
who was fresh off Hurt Locker, had yet to do the Marvel Universe. And the great Zoe Kazan. It's a spectacular cast, a very funny show, very memorable. It's my honorable mention in the Broadway edition. When I was a kid in the 1970s, I have no opera on this. I know opera hews close to musical concerts, but as we know, it is a narrative form. And as a kid, and this is the thing, no opera has ever lived up to this memory, but my memories of being a child, and we're talking single digits child, right? I'm no more than eight. I see a production by the San Francisco Opera of The Barber of Seville, and I'm in the second row, and did I understand any of it? No, and yet this whole thing made so much sense to me as a kid. The operatics of it, the production design, the costumes, I was blown away thinking, yeah, this, I want to live in this world. I don't mean the world of creating these things. I want to live in the world of these grand gestures and grand emotions.
Wow.
So, and no opera has ever lived up to that experience for me again. Finally, two final honorable mention categories. honorable mention the Hugo Armstrong edition. Listeners to the show, longtime listeners, have heard me mention Hugo Armstrong. For my money, the best actor working in Los Angeles. Most people will never have heard of him because he works almost exclusively on stage. I first saw him in the award-winning Bleed Rail at Boston Court. It is the scariest performance I have ever seen on stage or screen. He was unbelievably effective and delightful in the production of Waiting for Godot at the Amundsen, a production you and I discussed. And I loved him in Land of the Tigers from the Burglars of Ham. Those are the three greatest performances I've seen from the man who is at least the finest stage actor in Los Angeles. And finally, honorable mention must go to the 25th anniversary production of Abundance when it came home to South Coast Rep, which featured in one of the 10 greatest stage performances I've ever seen, none other than Lily Holloman.
That's right.
So that leads
us... I think I saw that too, yeah?
...to our top 10.
Right. Jeez, where to start?
Number 10. Start with number 10.
I'll start with number 10. Well, I didn't actually number these. I think I'm going in sequential order.
Well, that's
great. How about
great.
We do that from
okay, that's fine. Number 10.
So here's the thing. You knew Richard Harris, fine British actor. You know him from tons of movies. Sir Richard Harris. Well, I saw
Unforgiven,
him live.
The Dumbledore Unforgiven. Roles. So many great things.
Exactly.
Okay.
So many great things. What people don't know is that he lived in a hotel off of Hyde Park, and he owned the rights to Camelot, the play, the musical, and then would just take all the props and hire actors and go on tour. And in the 80s, I saw him perform Camelot in Vancouver. And it was phenomenal because you could see here's an actor in his prime, in his glory, and not only could he own the part of King Arthur, but he was also owning the show. Like, he owned the show, and it was so amazing. I still think of that to this day, seeing Richard Harris. I think it was in the last decade of his life, do Camelot.
And it's interesting that, I mean, maybe the play on words is intentional. I mean, as you said, he owned the rights, but he really did own that show. He owned every
he
moment
did own
of that show. Even when so he true. Was he, not he, on, his shadow was cast over everything.
Absolutely. And, you know, I guess it was the easiest thing to do is just take that around and then take all that money and pay off his hotel bill and go back.
You
and
have
then when
to
they need
love
more
it,
cash,
though, don't
take
you?
It off.
You have to love it, though. I mean, it's not...
Love it.
You can't say that it's easy, because it's any live performance. That is quite an energetic expense. So he has
absolutely.
To, he has to love it. I have a two-way tie for 10th. One is a one-man show that we actually mentioned last week when remembering Jonathan Demme. I saw at UCLA the 20th anniversary performance of Swimming to Cambodia. Spalding Gray did a 20th anniversary as a fundraiser for an arts program at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And I was a huge fan of the Jonathan Demme documentary. And this, for people who don't know, Spalding Gray was an actor and a writer and a performance artist and a monologuist who had done a one-man show largely about his experiences filming The Killing Fields, the Oscar-winning film The Killing Fields. And so this became an 80s one-man show, and it was turned into an unbelievably great documentary film by Jonathan Demme. So 20 years later, seeing this show that I knew so well, now, word for word the same, it's an entirely different show. Because the man who told these stories 20 years on in his life was a man who embodied a completely different energy and really a completely different outlook on the world than the man who had written those words. And so when 2 days later we found out that Spalding Gray had killed himself, it was no surprise to me, or I imagine anyone who was in the audience that night, as those words in Swimming to Cambodia took on the meaning maybe that they always had, but that he was ready now to truly convey, which was that script was a suicide note.
Right. And I saw him in Vancouver for his five-night sold-out show of Monster in a Box. And in that, it's a story of him being unable to write his novel that he later did write, called Impossible Vacation. And it's about him literally unable to take a vacation. Every vacation that he goes to, either Ireland or to Russia, is filled with hilarious gaps and all sorts of things. But in that Monster in the Box, the core of that is his mother's suicide and how it's reflecting on his future suicide as well. So it's fascinating that we both saw Spalding Gray at times where his suicide echoed through his work.
I love one-person shows. I always have been fascinated by them. I really do think as a form, they're just fascinating. I mean, I know the joke in this town is do the one-man show because, you know, the economics support it, right? But thank God the economics support it, because they're terrific. And my list is a testament to the impact that one-man shows can have. In fact, tied at number 10, far from being the ending of a man's expression and career, it's the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Because in 1999, I attended at the Zephyr Theater in Melrose a show called Paranoia Will Destroy Ya. And I have never before nor never since seen a show as funny. And that was, of course, a one-man show performed by Mr. Dean Haglund.
Aww,
I was
there
bringing a filmmaker to see you perform this, because I had said I was casting this filmmaker's movie. It ultimately never got made, as is so often the case. But then you and I worked together on a variety of things. But I brought this filmmaker to see you in it because I said, if all you know him from is The X-Files, you don't know him. You don't know all that he has to offer. And it was a film with a really wicked comedy streak to it. So I thought he ought to avail himself of seeing this. So anyway, that was why I was there. And that was the takeaway. I had never before and never since seen anything as funny.
Ah. Thanks. Yeah, that's sweet.
So,
well, let's see.
What's your number 9?
Well, technically, I guess was Spalding Gray was just an add-on. So, my number 9, let's see.
That's how he felt. He always felt that Spalding Gray was just an add-on, which is why the depression set in. But your number 9.
Let's say, well, there's a thing that goes on in Vancouver every year called Bard on the Beach. And what is phenomenal about this is the staging of all the Shakespearean classics. They do 2 or 3 in rep, but the stage itself is placed right on the beach and aligned with the sunset, so that there's no back wall. It's just a stage with minimal props, and they start just as the sun is setting and beaming into your eyes, into the audience. So they actually have a start time that varies 2 minutes per evening as the sun sets later and later. So as the sun is literally behind the actors, you see the beginning of the Shakespearean play. And then the sun sets and you have that twilight glow. And then they slowly add lights as the play progresses. So for me, all of those have always been particularly amazing. But it was Romeo and Juliet at the beginning of that, where you are blinded by the sun, and how that added to the blindness of the love story, the tragedy. That was really phenomenal. So if you're ever in Vancouver, give yourself a chance to go see Bard on the Beach on a sunny evening when the sun sets, and it's part of the stage design.
with a testament to that, to me, is that you're remembering Romeo and Juliet, because I would think if anyone would have their knives out ready to criticize a production of Romeo and Juliet, it would be you. You're not prone to easy sentimentality in any way.
No, absolutely.
So for them to really evoke the power of the material, for you to be saying that, I think really says a lot about that production.
Absolutely. And I think there was a lot, I think blindness, because you're blinded. There was a blinding in love, the blindness of the two houses, two families fighting each other for no reason other than they hate each other. It would seem that that was like a through line that the director took.
What a wonderful through line. That nothing blinds us like love except hate, which also blinds us.
Right. And the sun itself.
Yeah.
It also blinds you. Yeah. So it was really great.
As I mentioned with you, and talking to that director and saying, if all you know, Dean, is from the X-Files, there's so much more. Really, a case could be made that if you, no matter how much you love an actor, if you've only seen them in film or on television, you haven't seen them. Which is not to say that they might be better on stage. Indeed, I've had the experience of seeing actors that I really enjoy on screen, big or small, and then they are underwhelming on stage. And you realize how much of creating a performance on screen is what would you say? It's a group effort.
It's a group effort.
It's a collaborative process, right?
Right.
On stage, however, you're seeing what the individual has uniquely to offer. And so there is no way that for a truly great actor, you could ever get all that from the screen. And then there are some actors who, much as I always loved them, I always felt a certain sadness that I felt they never got the opportunity on screen to really show all of what they had to offer. And one of these was Tim Curry. Yes, he's delightful in Rocky Horror Picture Show and in supporting turns in several other films. But I saw him at the Curran Theater in San Francisco in an otherwise somewhat forgettable throwaway musical comedy entertainment, Me and My Girl. But I was so entranced by everything that Tim Curry did. Every moment. Like you said with Richard Harris, Tim Curry owned this stage. And the other thing that happened was to really drive home to me the power of the moment, if well chosen, where you break the fourth wall. There was a joke, a pun, that Tim Curry's character utters. And someone in the audience was a little slow on the uptake. And that someone, a boy in his teens, let's call him Phil Lernis, suddenly got the joke and laughed out loud well after the laughter from everyone else had died down. Curry stops in the middle of the line he's delivering, looks at this boy, winks, asks, "Are you ready?" And when I nodded, went on with the show. And it brought the house down. Tim Curry, Me and My Girl.
That's pretty funny.
Number 9. What's your number 8, Dean Haglund?
Wow, let's see. Since we're talking theater, there was a really cool show. I don't know if it's ever been done again, but it was a Shakespeare play. And you know that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is the two secondary characters from Hamlet that have their own show. Well, imagine that you take over a old city hall in Vancouver and you put on Hamlet and Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and I think the other one was Henry IV, Part 4, over three levels of the theater, And at any point, you can walk and go watch, follow the other actors. So there's nowhere to sit. You are standing in Castle Elsinore. Everything is happening around you. And then when Rosencrantz and Guildenstern come in, there's other people following them. So you can then switch off from Hamlet to go follow Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And then as you go downstairs with them, there seems to be Henry IV part four or part three going on. I didn't really follow that one, but it was this such a cool interactive multi-level triple play going on that you could go again and again to watch and every night have it be different because it's also a different audience following you around. And yet they're all staying true to their iambic pentameter. They're all being, you know, it's really great actors and really fun staging. And so that was an interactive triple Hamlet, Rosencrantz, Guildenstern, and Henry IV part two, I think, or part three.
I wish that I had an immersive theater experience on here. I really do. But I...
What?
But I don't. You know, I mean, I was sick as a dog and missed sleep no more. So I don't have an experience.
Oh, I thought you... I got that on my list here, but
good,
I thought
good.
For sure
well, we'll get
you
to
had...
That. So I was so sick, and so I had to have someone pinch hit for me. So I've seen other immersive theater experiences, but I haven't seen one that rose to the level. So I'm glad that, because I'm fascinated by them, and I'm interested in the idea of being involved, and someday we'll maybe have a talk about that. Combining immersive theater and documentary filmmaking. I actually have a very interesting idea forming. But anyway, my number eight continues this strain of actors that if you haven't seen them on stage, no matter how much you love them, you can only begin to scratch the surface of how much there is to appreciate in terms of what they have to offer. And this actor is French Stewart, who we had on this very show.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about my number eight show, Stoneface, directed by Jamie Robledo, which was the story of Buster Keaton performed on stage. This saw this three or four times at different venues. Number eight, I have it for when I saw it at the Sacred Fools Theater. It, of course, went to big equity houses after that. It was written by French Stewart's wife. This is a wonderful
birthday gift, I think.
A wonderful marriage of actor and role, and perhaps the most inventively directed stage show I have ever seen.
Right. Stoneface. I remember we popped in when he was on the show to watch the rehearsal of that, too. And even then, going through the physicality, it seems, you know, just being stunned at how French Stewart looked like Buster Keaton was a bit of a jaw dropper.
Yeah. Yeah. So
awesome.
What is your number seven?
My number seven, oddly enough, is, you know, I travel. I generally go and explore on my own, but occasionally I do the tours. I will follow up on some of the things that tourists do. And I went to Alcatraz in the 90s. Now, why I add the 90s is apparently the tour has become so popular that they had to close some of the parts that I got to visit that are no longer open to the public because of so many feet degrading the concrete and making it unsafe and stuff like that. But when I went there, and I forget the exact year, I was on the very first boat in the morning that when the prison opens for the tour, I think it's around 8 a.m. And I had managed to be there on the 8 a.m. boat. And because of the early days of the internet, I had got advanced word to go, when you get off the boat, make a beeline to get your headset and go on the tour. So I was basically by myself because everyone else makes a left. They go through the gift store. You get some background on what's going on. Instead, I went straight for the headset. And I don't know if this is still the case, but there were actual prisoners who were there just before the prison closed that are recording the tour in your head. So it's so I was basically by myself in Alcatraz with the voice of an ex-prisoner telling me everything about it, including going down to his solitary confinement where he'd spent months in the hole. And you get to go into that room, into that black room, and there's no other tour guide. There you are walking around by yourself. It was creepy. It was fascinating. It was theatrical. And then he said, you know, the hardest day was New Year's Eve because you could hear all the partying going across the bay, and here you are stuck in prison. And sure enough, when he said that, you could see all of San Francisco, and you could hear, you know, the traffic noise and everything coming from across the bay and how chilling that was. So the tour of Alcatraz that probably no longer exists from the 1990s is my number seven, eight. What are we on?
Seven. That's seven. Interesting. I never even thought of tours as a live event. That is a really interesting immersive experience. And I'm reminded yeah. of the tour we took of the Stasi prison in East Berlin.
Yes.
Where our guide was a former inmate who had been high school student at the time when he was in prison. Because in his civics class, he raised his hand and asked a question, why is it called the German Democratic Republic when we're not a democracy? And he wakes up in the Stasi prison. And
the Stasi prison for the next 3-4 years, wasn't it?
And I mean, the details of what he went through are harrowing. I mean, just in ways,
yeah.
You think that physical torture would be the worst, but physical discomfort over a long period
yes.
of time is actually worse because it's so psychologically grueling. And just the psychological pressure, we won't even get into it. We should maybe do a
right.
whole show about this. But the final
yeah.
just kick in the balls to this guy was, even when you're let out, the psychological torment continues because you find out that you've been two blocks away from your house the whole time and that no one in your neighborhood even has known that that's a prison. I mean,
isn't that amazing?
It's just,
yeah, that he found out about it only after the wall came down and then they
yeah.
opened the prison and then he went, oh, I should take a look at this thing in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then went, oh, this is where I was for 3 years.
So maybe that should have been on my list,
yeah.
but it's not. And so we'll talk about it.
It was on my list, but now we talked about it. So now
okay.
but I have an extra long list. So,
all right. Well, maybe we'll talk
Stasi
more about,
tour.
If anybody cares, we'll talk about that Stasi prison experience in the future. Because there is no
right.
footage of that in The Truth Is Out There. It's just something that we experienced. It is a live event.
Right.
So
yeah.
I put number seven instead. Very similar to those experiences, seeing a Chorus line.
What? That's very similar.
The big Fosse musical, A Chorus Line. Look, I am not a big fan of musicals. I think musicals are generally overblown, overrated. I think most of
mm-hmm.
them suck, honestly. Chorus Line, very much the exception, and one of the reasons is this monologue format. It's basically a series of one-person shows, which is really interesting.
Right.
But the monologues are so haunting, so affecting for anyone interested
mm-hmm.
in show business. But also, for me, the first time I see this as a prepubescent child, actually, so eye-opening in terms of what homosexuals had to deal with prior and would still have to deal with culturally to gain acceptance or to avoid ostracization in our society.
Mm-hmm.
It was really had a dramatic impact, as theater can, in terms of opening your mind and opening your heart to people who might seem so different. So that's
wow.
number seven. And also, might I say, it was the introduction of, to me, the kind of role, because I had aspirations of being an actor, being a theater boy, I was a mini minstrel for the Civic Light Opera in San Jose. The kind of role that I always knew was the one that I wanted to gravitate towards, the director in A Chorus Line. Always off stage. You only hear the voice. You don't even have to be off book, quite frankly. I loved
it.
I said, that's the perfect role for me. Anyway, chorus line is number 7. What's your number 6, Dean Haglund?
Wow, that is a good one. Number 6, when we were talking opera earlier, of course, I wasn't a member, but Plácido Domingo is now artistic director and has been since 2001 of the LA Opera. And they ambitiously, I guess it was four years ago, did Wagner's Ring Cycle. And we went and saw two of them, Das Rheingold and Siegfried, I think. And this was directed by that experimental director whose name always escapes me. What was that guy's name? You know.
Not Peter Sellers.
Not Peter Sellers. Ephraim.
Okay. And you know, I'm not talking about fiendish plot of Fu Manchu, Peter Sellers. I'm talking about the theater director, Peter Sellers. Okay. All right.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No, it wasn't Peter Sellers. It was, God, I had his name right here. Anyway, so this, the staging of this, of course, was also these giant puppet heads. You know, the story of Siegfried going down to hell, and it's a big Wagner classic, and the Ring Cycle is notoriously expensive to produce. It often takes a full year to see them all. Plácido Domingo himself performed some of the lead roles in this sort of thing as Sigmund himself, and it was amazing. It had... because it's about gods, the gods were these giant crazy puppets. The whole stage itself was on a 45-degree rake, if you can imagine. So these poor singers had to somehow negotiate on an uneven platform while walking in giant puppet heads singing, and yet there was a scrim in front of them that was projecting fire and other visual elements. It was a feast to the eye, to the ear, and to the senses. And still remember it to this day.
Wow, that sounds incredible. All right. And
it was incredible.
I'm sort of blown away that that's only number 6. Dear Lord. Okay, so number 6 for me, a little bit smaller scale in terms of its production, though still really impressively using all the tricks and artistry and craft and technology that theater can provide. I saw it in 1988 at the Curran in San Francisco, and it was a performance by Penn and Teller.
Oh.
I'm not a huge magic fan. I sometimes think neither are Penn and Teller, really, to be honest with you. But what's amazing about this was I saw them again at the Wiltern 2 years later, I think it was. They had totally changed their show. The show that I saw, so they clearly would always update it, but the show that I saw in 88 was so mesmerizing, so fascinating, so mysterious, so funny. Rarely have I seen a show as funny. And so heartbreakingly romantic. It was one of the most romantic shows I've ever seen. And again, when I say by 1990 in LA, the romance element was gone from the show. The humor was played up more. The tone was different. And this is the thing. Penn and Teller are true magicians in that the illusion is the tone that they create. That's the magic, right? They transport you through tone. Yes, the sleight of hand, extraordinary. Yes, the tricks, extraordinary. But have there been modern magicians that are artists in terms of the use of tone the way that those men are at their best? Not for my money. Anyway, number 6, Penn and Teller. What's your...
Wow, that's amazing.
What's your number 5?
My number 5, well, I think this is where Sleep No More shows up. Of course, this is the interactive retelling, perhaps, or possibly based on the story of Macbeth. For those who don't know, it's a word-of-mouth-only live show that takes place over 5 stories of a warehouse that... You are allowed to wander around and be in rooms that are lovely, set decorated. There's just standing by yourself in the mental ward, which are old 1950s hospital beds, with one of them just drenched in blood, blood all over the wall. So it's like a perfect 1950s hospital ward, except one bed. Something has gone horribly, horribly wrong. And if you stand in a room long enough, then suddenly the actors will come in and there'll be a crowd following them. You can follow other crowds. There's every direction you can go. And then they all gather for the final feast or the beginning feast twice in the production. And then you can go hang out at the restaurant that has a live band now. And I think this thing is still going on in New York, if I'm not mistaken. And I think it's gone into other venues as well because it's become so successful.
It was quite the crapshoot when they made it. They had spent so much money on building this hotel of the 1920s inside an old warehouse that they had no money for marketing the film.
Right.
The play, rather, the show.
The play.
And they relied on word of mouth, and it ends up becoming financially successful and indeed spawning other productions and, obviously, imitations. I have an immersive theater story to tell you on a future show. Hopefully, I will remember. But one of my acting students, Pat McNeely, a young lady in her 80s, who I first saw maybe in an acting class, but also maybe saw her in SciFest. But anyway, she became an acting student of mine, and she participated in the Tension experience here in Los Angeles for several months last year. And I still to this day am not sure if I would have the courage to go and see this. I know what the experience was. I'll share it. But there is a story from behind the scenes that I have been privy to of what some of these actors, but one actor in particular, went through. And it will blow your mind. So I'll share it on a future installment. I would share with you now about Sleep No More, the experience that Lily had the night when I was not able to attend. She let the actors know that she was game to become part of the play. There are ways you can do this. And before she knows it, she is grabbed, shoved into an examination room. There are no other audience. Her mask is pulled off. She is engaged in, basically, she's undergoing a psychiatric evaluation. And it lasts quite a while, and it ends with the woman psychiatrist kissing her and then throwing her out of the room. So it was an experience, a theatrical experience. Talk about it being ephemeral that only she had. I remember hearing something along the lines of, to see the entire show that was being acted out in Sleep No More would require going back 28 times to be able to see the whole thing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And I'm sure somebody's done it.
Probably, and that helps speak to both its quality, but also to its financial success, why that might have come to pass. All right. Number five for me, a show that I saw no less than four times, all with our friend Tucker Smallwood, but I saw it in different venues with different co-stars. And it is the play Sunset Limited, which would become an HBO movie with Tommy Lee Jones and Samuel L. Jackson. Tucker, and particular the one that I have as number five, is the performance, the two-hander done by him and Ron Botita at Rogue Machine Theater. And like I said, I saw it in different spaces. And what's fascinating is how the very same text, with the very same lead actor, in this case Tucker Smallwood, could be so different when you stage it in a different space. At Rogue Machine, we were raked. We were elevated in the audience, but we were right on top of this apartment set. We could even smell the coffee that was brewing in the coffee pot on the set. I wanted to reach out and get myself a cup of coffee. And we felt like we were in this bad, dangerous neighborhood where everything had to be double locked and barred and chained. When I saw it in Ventura at a theater, the stage is elevated. It created an entirely different dynamic between the piece and the audience, which changed the show energetically. Tucker, the same actor, is playing almost an entirely different character, a cousin of the character, perhaps, that he played at Rogue Machine. Also, this was because of the difference in embodiment between two equally great actors. In Ventura, he was with Joe Spano, famous for Hill Street Blues. But there was something about what Ron Botita brought to it, the angry depressive, the suicidal as an act of self-hatred, that brought something primal, something street out of Tucker's performance. And like I said, I would have gone back wherever he was doing it, whoever the co-star was, because each time it was different. But if I had to pick just once, it would have been that first time seeing Sunset Limited at Rogue Machine with Tucker and Ron Botita. The basic premise is a great one. It's about an ex-con who instinctively just reaches out and prevents a man from killing himself down in the subway, and thus doing so adopts this age-old adage that when you save a man's life, that man's life becomes your responsibility. And so he spends the duration of the show trying to make sure that this man will not just leave and try to kill himself again. So that's Sunset Limited, number five. What's your number four, Dean Haglund?
Well, my number four, A Celebration. You've probably seen it on TV, but it doesn't compare to being in it in the three dimensions, the 10 dimensions that it is. And I'm talking about the Sydney Fireworks Show at New Year's Eve. Holy crap. You know, it's one thing to see the shot. And what time do you see it? Like 2 in the afternoon, 3 in the afternoon on American televisions? When they say, hey, New Year's Eve's coming up and the ball's going to drop. And hey, here's what it looks like over in Sydney right now. And then you sort of see the Harbour Bridge explode with light. But that is just maybe one hundredth of the whole thing. We chartered the boat cruise that took you to the center of the harbor. And what they don't tell you is there's two fireworks shows. There's a 9 o'clock fireworks show for the kids, and then the actual midnight fireworks show, so the kids don't have to witness so many adults getting just liquored up. But this thing is highly organized. The pleasure boats are kept to the side. There's a stunt pilot air show before the sun goes down where he's flying under the bridge. And then the fireworks not only come off the bridge, but they come off the Sydney Opera House too. So if you're on the boat, you're immersed in a 45-minute fireworks show that surrounds you. And it's one thing to see it from the beach, but to have it go explode over your head and behind you is quite exhilarating. It's almost like that you're stuck in the middle of a lightning storm. And yet colorful. It's just phenomenal. So the Sydney Fireworks Show, I have to doff my hat as a live experience to be experienced live.
My number four could not be more different than that. One woman on a blank stage. And if there has ever been a more talented woman, it is a short list. I'm talking about Lily Tomlin, Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, her one-woman show at the Curran in San Francisco in 1987, where they had really perfected the script. Tour de Force doesn't quite cover it. You are seeing this woman bring so many human beings to life before your very eyes. I swear to God, in my mind's eye, I'm seeing her shapeshift. Right? I'm seeing her become different colors, different genders, different ages, different shapes, sizes, ethnicities. It is one of the truly seminal works of the stage. And it's my number four.
Wow, look at that.
What's your number three, Dean Haglund?
Well, let's change gears again. And this is during the Clinton administration, when yours truly and maybe two other or three other people from the Fox executive pool got a private tour of the White House, of all things. It seems that when Hillary Clinton was first lady, her chief of staff executive was an ex-Fox employee, and so knew many of the people who were there in Washington doing a convention, and I get a phone call going, Dean, you got your driver's license? Come on. We got to go to this thing that's totally top secret. And it was not a guided tour. It was just Hillary's guy and just walking around, eight of us, showing us many of the things that are on the tour and many of the things that are not on the tour, including the chance for me to get a picture of me as Langley hacking into Al Gore's work computer on his desk. So, you know, that was quite an experience to see the history of the place and see many of the other things that the tourists don't get to see. And it was both historical, fascinating, lots of laughs. We didn't get to go upstairs, of course. No one does when nobody's in the house. Both Bill and Hillary were off on some trip somewhere. So it was really quite cool. So there you go, the White House private poster.
Let me ask you, honestly, what is cooler? Is it cooler to be hacking into Al Gore's computer station, or is it cooler to be hacking into his liquor cabinet at the vice president's residence, the Naval Observatory, and doing underage drinking as Lily Holloman was doing on a regular basis?
Damn it.
Yeah.
That might be cooler.
Mic drop. All right. Number three, I'm heading to Broadway for these next two. My two favorite experiences ever, shows I've seen on Broadway. One is seeing the original Steppenwolf cast, the cast from Tony Award-winning production of August Osage County in the days leading up to their winning the Tony Award. The original cast had come back to do it in the weeks leading up to the Tony Awards as kind of a victory lap, and I got to see them. August Osage County, what a tremendous play if you see it with the right ensemble. Boy, casting can affect even a well-written play, and that ensemble was everything. I, in fact, heard that the Replacement ensemble made it a very good play. This is one of the greatest plays because of the ensemble. And, by the way, another role that Phil Lernis wants to play. There is the role of the patriarch of the family who sets up the show. It's a very long show, right? It's like 3.5 hours. And he sets up the show with a 20-minute monologue at the beginning. Then he's done. Mm-hmm. And I love monologues because you don't have to interact with other actors. Other actors are the worst. And then you're off set until 3 hours later you come back for the curtain call. And everybody loves you because because the whole show's been about you. And so I would do that. I would, what would I do? I would go, I would do my 20 minutes. I would then, because they have to have an early curtain since it's such a long show. And then you get to leave. You get to go see another Broadway show. You get to have a lovely dinner. And then you come back to accept the love from the audience. What a perfect gig for Phil Lernis. Now, this old man who played the part, he's a bit more ambitious than me. And he was in another Broadway show that was running at the time. So he would rush out the door, run across the street to the other theater, get into the wardrobe and make up for that show, do that show, accept his curtain call, then run back across the street to get his curtain call for August Osage County. Anyway, that's my number three. What's your number two, Dean Haglund?
This is a time when Chris Carter and the X-File group thought that the way conventions were done were terrible, so they decided to do their own. The Fox executives blew a ton of cash and did a 10-city tour of America as a sci-fi X-Files convention called the X-Files Expo. And I did all of them. I did my show. But what was memorable about this one was they often tried to go to cooler venues. So they weren't just doing conventions. They would often find, decommissioned air bases. And what we found in D.C. was the White Oaks Weapons Testing Facility that had been recently decommissioned. And in between signing and stuff, you had free access to walk around this facility where some weird shit had gone on, because there was, for instance, I personally saw the pressure chamber, I take it, that seemed to have 8 inches of glass into a viewing hole that seemed to have some sort of stuff on the inside. I don't know what got pressurized in there, but there was they hadn't cleaned it out. It seemed that they just abandoned this thing, so much so that I went to another room, and there on the whiteboard was a massive algebraic algorithm, some formula, that equaled, at the end, neural disruption. So what? I don't know what weapon. Yes. Yeah, there was like, oh, they were working on a neural disruptor in this room. And other people, some of the drivers, you know, that were driving around the props and the interactive X-Files stuff, said they picked up cassette tapes that had them discussing future Iraq wars, and for instance. So this place was amazing, and it had no heat. So the show I did, I was probably the closest I ever came to having heat exhaustion on stage. And they couldn't air condition this place because in the back area that was as the green room, painted on the wall, it said, "Do not cause dust, carcinogenic." So the dust itself on the ground, we were told not to kick up too much dust because breathing it in would give you cancer. So that was a pretty memorable experience, both on and off, walking around what a weapons testing facility looks like, or looked like, when it was used, I think, from basically the late 50s till when it was decommissioned in 88, I'm going to say, 89, somewhere around there. So, yeah, that's my number two.
I mentioned Hugo Armstrong earlier in the show, and in the past, whenever we mentioned him, like when we saw Waiting for Godot, we always would hear, because we would tag him, and somebody had an alert set for metadata tags for Hugo Armstrong, some crazy dude who would write these rants to us about Hugo. I cannot wait for what we might welcome in the wake of using the metadata tag neural disruptor.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get a letter or two.
So, my number two, also on Broadway, a book that I would have thought could never be written, that is a mystery told from the point of view of an autistic child. That book is turned into a play that is absolutely impossible to be staged, and yet it's best staging of any work I have ever seen. Tony winner for best play, the show that everyone should have seen instead of wasting their money and their time on Hamilton, but it's no more on Broadway. Curious right. Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. This is such a heartbreaking work and such a thrilling and liberating and celebratory work. It's about autism. It's about family. It's about forgiveness. It's about how everyone has something special and unique to offer. And it's embodied in this production that requires everyone to think outside the box in terms of supporting what each other is doing. It's true ensemble, and it's even improvisational in ways. If there's ever a chance to see a true production of this, I fear the roving productions. I fear the regional productions. But
oh, really?
But as we'll talk about when we get to my number one. But Curious Incident right. of the Dog in the Nighttime, my number two. What's your number one, Dean Haglund?
Okay, so many of these shows are about the amazingness of the performance. But this is a show about a show going horribly wrong, an accident that I witnessed. And this is by a comedian who came to the Vancouver Comedy Festival in the 90s, an Italian comic named Leo Bassi.
This is, you know, one of my favorite stories you have ever told me. We were driving right? in rural British Columbia when you told me this story.
All right.
I think drunk, I've once asked you to tell me it again. but please, anyway, Leo Bassi, please.
Leo Bassi, yeah, you know this story. And he was this, you know, everybody said, you got to see this Leo Bassi guy. Holy smokes, what a comedian. Not just a comedy show. It's a psychological mind fight. It's a thriller. He starts in the rafters. So he's not even backstage. He's in the rafters of the theater, and he has a rope that he's going to let himself down when he's introduced, because he watches the audience come in, because he's done things like put $10 on one of the chairs and said a note, hey, John, this is for you. And he puts shaving cream in another one of the seats and then watches when the guy takes the shaving cream off, but then has his girlfriend sit in that chair. You know, all of these different things. So when they said, ladies and gentlemen, Leo Bassi, he rappels down from the ceiling at the back of the theater, runs, and then he goes, I know all your secrets. I know you did that. She's sitting in the whipped cream and you took the $10 and didn't give it to John. And like everybody's now freaked out. And then he goes, this is not a show about comedy. It's about danger. And he runs through the audience with a giant jerry can, a gas can of what you don't know, whatever the fluid is. He's pouring it all over the audience. And then he lights a match that then lights a torch. And he takes what you think is a drink of water, but it's actually lighter fluid. And he spits a giant flame out, as you see many a street performer do. And somehow he was a little cavalier when he threw the glass of lighter fluid into his mouth. And so his upper lip caught on fire. And when he felt that, he put it out and he smashed really hard on his mouth and spit out the second a gulp of lighter fluid that he had in his mouth, and it engulfed his head. His head caught on fire, if you can imagine. And he had short hair, but now he is now staggering around on stage with his head in flames, taking his jacket, trying to put himself out. He trips over some of the props, and nobody knows if this is the show. Like, everybody's going, this is an amazing act. And guy's got his head on fire. And then he puts his head out. The lights change. And he says to the guy in the lights, go lights. And I guess that's a cue to go to his end bit, where he lies on his back and he juggles with his feet six basketballs. So they play the music, and this is all backlit in blue. So I think he's just buying himself time now that he's burnt his head, and then he juggles the basketballs, everyone claps, and then he now stands up, and there's a gasp in the audience because he is charred, his ears are bleeding, and he sits at the edge of the stage. There is silence, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, what you saw is a mistake. Now I can either keep going, or we could just end the show here and call it a night. And everybody doesn't know, is this part of the show too? This is like a wild, electric, theatrical experience, unlike any has anybody seen. And one of the waitresses, because this theater had, you could serve alcohol, one of the waitresses goes, Leo, and she hands him her compact mirror, and he takes a look at himself, closes the compact, and goes, good night. And he just gets up and goes. He didn't realize how badly he had burnt himself.
Wow.
And so some of the people are giving him a standing ovation. Other people are pissed off and their arms are crossed and they're asking for their money back because he only did 5 minutes and they paid for an hour of Leo Bassi comedy. And all of us who we were the opening act, everybody had a slightly different version of what they just saw. A guy whose head ignited, you'd think everybody would have the exact same beat for beat instance of what had happened. But as we all repeated it, because one of the actors goes, what did we just see? And then everybody said, well, you know, clearly he puts his head on fire. That's part of his act. You go, no, that was a giant mistake. He can't do that night after night. And it was like, that for me is the number one theatrical experience that you'll never see again.
I mean, there's another one that you've described that I may on a future show. This has introduced a whole lot of stories that we might need to share on future shows. So I'll table this.
Okay.
But there is a story that you have about witnessing a disabled comedian.
I also
want you to share if you can at some point, but we'll do this on a future, you'll kind of need to have to, because it's somewhat in the vein of this, not nearly extreme as
not
extreme
nearly,
or whatever,
but yeah, but funny,
but it's an amazing thing to have witnessed. Anyway, we're so far over time, but I hope everybody's really enjoyed this episode. I conclude with my number one. I love actors. I love ensemble. I like things that are truly uncomfortable. You know, this comedy of discomfort has become such shtick. But when it was in the hands in television of the British Office or Larry Sanders Show before that, what made it uncomfortable was how truthful it was.
Yes.
And one of the things that allows for truth to emerge is the discomfort of taking your time. Actors are not behaving like authentic human beings often because they have this innate sense, or they're being directed by an outside force to pick up the pace, to cut out the air, to, you know, because we're worried about keeping it entertaining. And real life is what emerges during those pauses. Real life is what comes into play during the silences, where you don't know what's going to happen as a performer. And there is a playwright named Annie Baker who understands this, so much so that she not only writes in all the pauses, she defines the pauses at the beginning. And since theater is a playwright's medium, you are supposed to heed every word in a script. You do not change the scripts without the writers say so. So I have read one of her pieces recently. It's something like 80 pages long, this play, and it was a three-hour play when it was produced.
Good Lord.
Because she'll say, when I write the word pause, that's a 12 alligator count.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and there's lots of pauses. So this is not that play, but this play has many, many pauses in it, and yet when you see it in regional theater, they cut the pauses out so they can shorten the play down to an acceptable hour without intermission. But when done to the script, as the great Sam Gold, whose work you've seen on Broadway, when it's directed by Sam Gold, there's nothing better than seeing an Annie Baker play, and especially, the off-Broadway award-winning Circle Mirror transformation. Sam Gold won every award possible for off-Broadway direction, for, handling, the premiere of Circle Mirror Transformation. He then brought that staging to Los Angeles, to South Coast Rep, and put together the greatest ensemble I've seen on stage. Linda Geringer was one of them, Maren Hinkle, Ari Gross, James Kerwin, and a very young Lily Holloman. And
yeah, that's right.
This play I ended up seeing a half dozen times, and I said this to someone recently, I would see that production of that play once a week for the rest of my life if I could, because it's one of those shows, especially with those pauses and especially with the built-in improvisation. The play is set in an acting class in Shirley, Vermont, over a period of weeks by amateur actors. So the exercises they're doing are improv exercises. So much of this articulated, scripted, structured work allows for the improvised moment. The pauses allow for real life, for the actors to let in whatever's going on in their lives. And it's one of those shows where it just deepened and deepened and deepened. James Kerwin was in that original Steppenwolf cast of August Osage County. And he said that the first time in his life, because he's done a lot of stage, and he said that was the first time in his life where he would have done a show until he got sick of doing it, and then would have kept doing it, because he got to the point after he was sick of doing it where he then wanted nothing but to do it forever. That you hit that wall with the play. Most plays, when you hit that wall, you know it's time to go. But rarely, and in the case of August, Osage County was the first, where he knew it was important to stick with it because you would plunge through to that point where you knew you could do it every night and never reach bottom, that you would discover more and more and more. The second such experience he had with that was with this production of Circle Mirror Transformation. It was a nightly masterclass in acting. And that's my number one, and that brings us to an end of a 75-minute installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. So why don't we just say goodbye, and we'll see you next
week. Yeah.
And we'll try to do better. I'm Phil Larenas.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.